decade of dissident discourse. It can only be millennial. And now here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial X. This is now the 13th night and it's the final night of interviews. There will be four interviews tonight, but and then there will be the Christmas card stream. But I should say that one of the interviews is different from advertised. It was supposed to be with Mouthy Buddha, who appeared on Millennial in 2017. So it would have been nice to hear from him again. Unfortunately, he told me today, it's rather exasperating, but he told me today that he couldn't make it. So I hurriedly asked that there were people in reserve. So I asked, and instead of in his slot, instead of him, it will be a Canadian organization called the Company of Adventurers. So in 2 hours from now, it will be Arvel, then the Company of Adventurers, and then Josh Neal, and then the Christmas card stream. But first, I am here with Frode Midyard of Guide to Culture and the Skansa Forum and various other things. Frode, would you like to introduce yourself?
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for having me on. You're doing an heroic effort with all these streams back-to-back several days or several weeks, really, in a row. I don't know what to say about, by ways of introduction. I think this is the seventh or eighth time or something like that I'm on.
I'll find out. Hold on a sec.
Yeah. I think the first year was 2017.
Yeah, definitely.
So I've been on since then. I have a channel called Guide to Culture. It's called, it's spelled culture, it's spelled K-U-L-C-H-U-R. It's from a book by Ezra Pound. I figured out that it was too difficult for people to spell, so they couldn't find the URL and so on. So I just changed the name, or I have an alternative name, just GTK Radio. So GTK for Guide to Culture. So the website is gtkradio.com. I do the Skansa Forum conferences, which is not really on a sort of regular schedule now. It's a bit chaotic. We do them every now and then. I think I've done about 11 or 12 of those conferences since 2015. And before that, well, in 2015, it wasn't even called the Skansa Forum, but I started doing conferences back then. And I do a weekly show with Mark Weber called Weekly Roundup every Tuesday evening, where we talk about the current events. I do the Decameron Film Festival, an annual thing since the first COVID lockdown in 2020. So this was the fifth year in a row. And various other things. I've been involved in these things since the late 90s. So it's strange to think that I'm a bit of a veteran these days, because it still feels like I'm a very young man, but maybe I'm getting old. I don't know.
Well, I was a late starter. You know, you've been in this for, I started in 2014. So it's like 15 years after you. This is amazing because, you know, I feel kind of grizzled. I feel like I've been in this for quite a long time, but you've been in it for a lot longer. I should say that this is your eighth appearance on Millennial. So right. Every year since 2017.
Yeah.
So it's a funny thing about that. There are people who've been in it for decades. I know a guy who's been in this since the late 60s.
Yeah.
It's quite remarkable, really.
Yeah, but I mean, people like Jared Taylor. You had Jared Taylor on. My colleague Mark Weber, he's been involved since the 60s. Of course, Sam Dixon has as well been involved since the 60s. And, you know, people like Sam and people like Mark, they've met really the old guard. You know, they've known, like, people whose names you would recognize and so on. And so But I like that, because I think that tradition, you know, a sense of continuity is important. That's what, I mean, if we use the distinction between left and right, then right is all about tradition. And you don't have to reinvent the wheel. There's a lot to be learned from previous generations. One thing that I've noticed is, of course, that there's a pattern, that maybe you don't see at first. You see some problems in society and so on, but then you see a pattern in, you know, that some people come, some people go, some people understand, you know, a part of the issues, and other people understand more of the big picture, and so on. So you kind of see which things will last and which things are just, you know, temporarily involved, and, you know, people, because I've seen that, you know, things like the alt-right, it's not the first of its kind. There are other that type of things that have come and gone over the years. So I think that's perhaps one of the useful things with having a long experience involved in the issues that we talk about, is that you see sort of a recurring pattern, and you see sort of what has staying power.
That's an interesting point. Would you say that the alt-right, you say that it wasn't the first of its kind. Would you say that it was original in any way? I mean, do you see it as any sort of watershed?
Absolutely. I think it was. I think it was original in many ways. I think, well, it really depends on what we mean by the alt-right, because, of course, Richard Spencer and some other people started using the term alternative right already back in 2010 or something like that. And it was very much an American thing back then. It was very much an American thing from an American political point of view. So it's very different from the European perspective. And I thought perhaps that when Europeans started adopting that term, that it didn't really work in the same way, because America has a very different political context. But then, of course, the big alt-right came around, you know, in 2014-15 with first the migrant crisis in Europe and the Donald Trump and Brexit and these types of big historical events. And of course, it also coincided with change in technology. And, you know, I mean, people like Jared Taylor back in the 90s and Mark Weber and so on, you know, they had to print up things and people had to search for the information and, you know, like old school mail order things, you know, they had to send a letter and put money in an envelope to buy magazines or books or whatever. And all of a sudden with blogs and vlogs, anyone could participate and reach huge numbers, you know, whereas in the past maybe it was a few hundred people, now all of a sudden it was hundreds of thousands of people. And so it was original in many ways, and especially in terms of technology, I think.
Yeah, I think also in terms of the cool factor, which I don't think nationalism had really had before. I think there was, and I think this kind of emanated from the personality of Richard Spencer to some extent. The fact that that sort of arrogance, being quite confident, quite okay with being unpopular, controversial views. I think previously nationalism had seemed quite joyless and reserved. Whereas the alt-right was quite bombastic and, as I say, exuberant might be the word, but also just slick and cool. I think people who would have steered clear of nationalism felt authorized to take part in it because of the attitude and style of the alt-right. As I say, I do think that really emanates from Spencer particularly. But I mean, there were other aspects to it as well. The sort of shambolic, like the right stuff kind of aspect to it. And then the European aspect. And the interlocking with previous eras of nationalism as well. So there's a lot to it. I was just wondering, I don't really intend to ask you in depth about this or to talk about it for the full stream. It just came up. So I'm sort of, because it's something that we don't talk about now. It happened. We talked about it retrospectively for a couple of years. Then COVID happened, and that just wiped everything out. So it's interesting now to think about it as a thing that retrospectively, as a thing that happened once. I mean, I don't really see a clear dividing line between the alt-right and the dissident right. I think it's sort of evolved quite gently from one into the other, forged mostly by COVID, I would say, by the sort of trauma. I mean, for a lot of people, COVID was a very disturbing experience. And again, especially in Europe. So I think that might be something that distinguishes, helps to distinguish the alt-right, so the dissident right from the alt-right as more of a European thing.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. I mean, I think the sort of the radical right before the alt-right was seen as a rather, like you said, perhaps a little bit joyless, very analytical, a bit uptight, a bit stuffy. But then all of a sudden, the sort of online culture for, you know, all its problems that I've pointed out many, many times, and maybe I've made some people angry for pointing out some of the problems with online culture, but it did have a lot of positive effects as well. I mean, and like you said, it was cool in many ways. It was funny. It was relaxed, and it was emotional rather than just analytical. Because I think that you've probably talked to other guests about this as well, that there's a sort of a personality difference in politics where leftists these days, at least, or maybe not even these days, but in the past decades, in the post-war era, have been more of the creative, artistic personality type, whereas the right-wingers have been more of the sort of logical, analytical, engineer type personality. And that creates an obstacle for communication because people are not logical creatures. It doesn't matter that you have the right argument and or that you're analytically correct about what you say, because the things that are right now have been in books available in logical manner for thousands of years and hundreds of years. It doesn't matter. It doesn't get applied in everyday life because it doesn't have that sort of cultural momentum. And so I think the alt-right was also, like you said, it was emotional, it was more easygoing. And, you know, there's a lot to complain about in sort of in terms of American political culture, but there's also a lot of positive things in American political culture. I think that perhaps European political movements have more of a sort of maturity. They're more mature. They have a longer experience. Europe is an older civilization than Europe. And so there is this old kind of wisdom and long-term understanding, but there's also an old kind of senility. So it's like European political movements are more like tired and senile, whereas American political movements have been more energetic, more lively. And so they've been like a teenager, you know, very energetic, but also stupid sometimes and made many mistakes, you know, just running head first into traps and misunderstandings and misinterpretations and so on. But I think there's a lot to be learned from both sides there. And I think that the injection of energy that came from the American alt-right was it did a lot of good to Europe as well. And so, you know, we went, if we talk about right-wing ideas, went from being completely marginal, you know, a lot of people who are very invested and have been invested for decades, but didn't really have much of a reach, to suddenly reaching hundreds of thousands of people. And, you know, things that maybe I and a handful of people talked about years and years ago, now they've sort of trickled down into even mainstream discourse. We've even seen people like Donald Trump mention the word like re-migration and so on, right? And re-migration has been a sort of just a household taken for granted talking point in national populist political parties in Europe for 40 years. But it's just now all of a sudden that it sort of broke through. And that's thanks to a lot of, you know, online milieus and these things. So there's a lot of power in it, you know. So there's, you know, there's a negative side and a positive side with it, because it does tend to move in the territory of Jerry Springer, right? Sometimes where the fun takes over and it lacks all seriousness, which is a problem. But then again, there has to be that balance, because you can't be too serious and too analytical either. You also have to have that forward energy where you don't, you know, the Italian fascists have their sort of slogan back in the 1920s was me ne frego, which means fuck it. Just I don't care. I don't give a shit, which is just an attitude, a sort of a very youthful, energetic, masculine attitude, just, well, screw it. You know, it's a sort of a fearless, flippant attitude. And I think there's something like that needed, because the sort of over-analytical, over-bourgeois, polite, conservative politics doesn't really work. I mean, it doesn't work. It's too apologetic almost.
And by the time it's made its arguments, the enemy have made their moves.
Yeah,
that's it drains the energy out of a room. It just analyzing, and then no one's got any energy left to actually do anything. That's a problem. And I agree with everything you said. It's very interesting. One thing you said was that America, at least the political side of America, has a lot of dynamism and energy, which is lacking in Europe. Obviously, organizations like Generation Identity have tried to combat that by injecting energy, being optimistic and explicitly youthful as well. I think there's an age limit of 30. After you're 30, you've got to step away from the activism side in GI, that's their policy. Mm-hmm. Do you think that Europe itself, I mean, this is a complicated question because even America now seems more tired than it did in our youth, in the 80s and 90s. America now seems already that it's starting to limp and shuffle and be regretful. So when I say that America is youthful and dynamic and energetic, it comes with that caveat that America is already doubting itself, doubting its existence, its right to exist and so on. But how would you compare that with Europe? Because obviously Europe is ancient compared to America. And do you think that that is a very serious problem? Because is it the case that we simply won't win this? The hearts and minds, the debates, the fights, and even the wars, unless we are energetic, unless we are youthful, unless we menefrego.
I mean, there's a sense in which. Excuse me, I didn't catch the last sentence there.
How would you just compare America and Europe in terms of youth and dynamism and what is going to be needed?
Yeah. I think there's a problem. This is something that the philosophers in Greece understood as well, that when you take a step back and just look at society from the outside and you're not longer a part of it, then you get a sort of a cold analytical mind that makes you less powerful because you're not as invested. You just analyze it. You just pick it apart and sort of look at it in a cold way. And I think that's a problem of sort of old societies. They become too analytical, too philosophical in many ways. And America is more youthful. And I think you're absolutely right that America is losing quickly a lot of its youthful energy. So America was this enormously powerful country that just burned out very quickly, I think. And I think that there's a lot of, in American political culture right now, a lot of people are acknowledging that, at least implicitly, because what is the slogan of Donald Trump now? Well, it's make America great again. And like my colleague, Mark Weber, has said many times, well, that implies that America is no longer great. And there's also a sense of decline. There's a sense that people did look up to America decades ago, up until maybe the 80s, saw America as a role model. People wanted their cities to be like American cities. There's still some of that, but in generations that are kind of clueless because they're sort of seeing America through the media of past decades. And I think that there's also, this also comes up in the aesthetics that America is trying to, or the sort of MAGA movement, the Trump movement is trying to appeal to the 80s. It's really an attempt to return to sort of the Ronald Reagan attitude, Make America Great Again is really a slogan from Ronald Reagan. And Donald Trump has adopted the sort of 80s aesthetics with Hulk Hogan and so on, like the celebrities that he surrounds himself with and the sort of the pro wrestling entrance and so on. That is an aesthetic and a vibe from the 80s and early 90s, perhaps. And this is also funny because, even Vladimir Putin has sort of his American celebrity is Steven Seagal, another guy who was famous in the 80s. So it's very much sort of that this movement, the populist, slightly conservative right-wing movement now, is appealing to a few decades ago, the power that was there a few decades ago, because they feel that it ran out. And so people want to get back to that. So it's a movement of nostalgia, trying to get back to that energy. And also, I mean, this also is shines through in sort of racial policies. A lot of people have talked about this image from the movie The Predator, where Arnold Schwarzenegger and the black guy, what's his name, Carl Weathers?
Yeah,
where they lock arms in a sort of arm wrestling pose. And, you know, this is sort of like, we're cool together. So we get past the sort of the woke thing where black people are angry at white people and want to get back. Instead, we can be friends. It's sort of 48 hours or the sort of Eddie Murphy type of black people where everyone is cool together. We're all friends. We can do this together. Everyone can be a winner. It's very much a 1980s attitude. And I think that is because Americans feel that, well, their society has declined and has run out of this powerful energy. And so they sort of want to get back to that. And I think that's really the wave that Donald Trump has been riding on.
Yeah, there's a lot there. But for now, let's switch it to Europe. And because what I'm thinking is, I think you and I enjoy and respect, like, something like, for example, an ancient Italian village. Mm-hmm. It's nice, and we understand that it's something that it's ancient, and it has a million stories encoded in it that we'll never know, but they're there, and yeah. we can sort of feel them. We can feel the history. We're aware of it. It is there. It just is there. It's a fact. That kind of thing feels meaningful, but it's no match for a horde of Africans. Or a horde of Muslims, or indeed a globalist bulldozer just coming in and putting up some glass and steel thing. That's a fact. You know, I wish it weren't the case. I wish that the history would sort of speak for itself and fight for itself, and that time would equal strength and vigor, but it doesn't. That village can easily, like some bureaucrat somewhere, maybe not even a white one, I remember about the heritage minister in Sweden with the Viking artifacts.
Yeah,
some bureaucrat somewhere can just, with a stroke of a pen, say, okay, this village, it's been there for 1,000 years, 1,500 years, maybe even longer, but now it needs demographic rejuvenation, and so it's going to be African from now on.
Yeah.
And there's really nothing that the history doesn't resist this, the age and the dignity of something. And, you know, I'm talking about an Italian village. It could be a German village, a French village, a Scottish village.
Yeah.
It doesn't put up any resistance. And indeed, the denizens of these villages are tired, and frequently they are old. I don't know if you've... If you go around these villages, a lot of European people are old, the young people are colored. They're black or whatever. Now, I'm not saying I really don't want to be a doom monger, especially on Christmas Eve or on what is Christmas Day in some parts of Europe. I really don't want to, but I'm not even off that mind. I don't think that all is lost or that we're doomed or whatever. I'm just trying to. I want to get your perspective on this. Do you think that... See, I think this is why, for us, for Europeans, the American energy was useful with the alt-right.
Yeah.
Because it sort of gave us permission to have energy ourselves. But left to our own devices, we don't. And I guess part of that will be that America has sort of dominated us and held us down for 70 years, 80 years. But also just the age. How old it all is and how long it is. I mean, it's 100 years since Europe. See, that's another thing, actually. That's a whole other aspect to it, is that 100 years ago, Europe was extremely energetic, the various empires and so on. Anyway, what would you say about all of that?
No, I think you're right. And I think on a positive note, I don't really believe in the sort of Spenglerian decline where there's a sort of a deterministic process where you have to decline, you have to enter into this self-destruction mode as soon as you reach the peak of civilization. Because I do think that the decline that we have seen in the post-World War II era in Europe has been forced upon us from above and from outside. This is not a natural decline in any way. This has been forced basically at gunpoint. Europe was split into two, and the Western half was governed by America. The Eastern half was governed by the Soviet Union. Both are entities that are that are European colonies, really, but who became anti-European in their sort of imperialistic expansion mode. And so they started committing patricide, basically. They started killing their parents in their own roots, chopping off their own roots in many ways because of this sort of imperialistic impulse. But that is slowly fading away. And I am, in many ways, more hopeful for Europe than I am for America, at least in its current sense, because there is a natural taken for granted understanding that European countries are sort of ethnic creations and that they are built by a people with an ancestry. And it's just obvious if we talk about European history that, well, if we talk about, if you talk about Scottish history or British history from, 200, 400 years ago or 1,000 years ago, those are your people you're talking about. A person who came here, 25 years ago is not his people. That history is about, is not. Whereas, so there's just a natural understanding that we are sort of a society, we're not just individuals. Whereas in America, there is an individualism. People can reject on a sort of theoretical basis that, well, it's not a country of immigrants, Europeans created it and so on. Yes, it's true, but they created it as individuals. So individualism is sort of hard-coded in the American psyche. And I don't think they can get away with it. Even people, I've been surprised through all my experience that when I talk to Americans, even who are sort of radically on the right, who are really understand everything that you and I understand and have understood them for 20, 30, 40, 50 years, they're still sort of libertarians in their basic, that's their sort of factory setting, is this sort of individualism, libertarianism, and they still think in terms of individuals, right? And in a way that Europeans don't really do. Europeans have started doing that in the post-World War II era largely because of American sort of Hollywood culture and so on, because that's the nature of capitalism. Capitalism is individualist. But really there is this basis for, a lot of people who, I think it's also, you and I, people like us, we sort of live in a bubble where we follow the discourse and the debate very closely. Most people still don't do that. And most people live their lives. Most people don't mix really ethnically and have mixed kids and so on. They live their lives. And I do think it's possible to reset these things. And when pressure from the outside becomes weaker, it becomes even more and more possible. And there is a backlash against all these things. And of course, the political establishment tries to sort of derail that or hijack that energy, but I don't think they're going to succeed with that entirely, because there is a sort of a genuine understanding that, well, we are a people, we are a nation, and so on. And I think that is, Americans think more in a sort of an abstract racial term, in the sense that, well, we're white people, and it's a very sort of simplistic kind of way, whereas we have a more natural, organic way of thinking about our own people as, a shared ancestry and so on. And it's obvious that this has been forced upon us. This isn't really accepted. People don't like it. Things that were controversial just a few years ago, 5 years ago, people don't raise an eyebrow if you talk about them now. Just in my everyday life, I encounter this when people talk about the problems in our society. It's not even controversial, and really, the type of deplatforming efforts that we saw, in 2016, 17, 18, how would they even do that today? I mean, there are so many people talking about these things that how would that even be possible? You know, it's like there has been a genuine shift where the things that we realized maybe decades ago, that's more or less taken for granted now in society.
On the matter of deplatforming, I think Google, like if YouTube decided to just ban a lot of people like they did in 2018 and 19 and so on, today, I think they would get away with it. They would manage each individual one, and there would be complaints about each individual banning, but they would just sit out the storm. They would get away with each individual banning, but I think it would the collective result of it would damage their reputation. I think there would be a lot of questions asked. What are you doing? Why is this happening? What is the line of on freedom of speech on your platform? I think they would get some pushback. They'd be held to account to some extent. I think that's the difference compared to 2018, where so many people were just unaware. They were just completely oblivious to what was going on. Whereas for us, it was very important. You know, I always think back to that Republican senator at this Congress where they were interrogating the heads of social media platforms. And this Republican guy asked him what he was doing to tackle hate speech on his platform. He didn't know that he was there. His job was to fight for freedom of speech. Yeah. I don't think that would happen now. It was infuriating to watch that. But that was like 2019 or something. I think you're right that wouldn't happen now. But as for that being because the issues are known, yes, that's part of it. I think they'll probably continue calling the Great Replacement a conspiracy theory for some time. But this is an example of them running up against reality. It's obvious. Yeah. Everyone can see it. It's just right there. You can't look at Paris, Berlin, London, and how drastically different they are just from how they were 20 years ago and say that something hasn't happened. Of course something has happened. Of course it has. Otherwise they would be the same as they were 20 years ago. So the only ambiguity is whether it's deliberate, but then of course it's deliberate because it's all being funded and orchestrated. So someone's organizing those buses to bring them in. So of course it's deliberate.
No, I think you're right, and but it's not just that it's widely known; it's also accepted in a different way. There has been a shift. I mean, with the new sort of shift with Elon Musk taking over Twitter, spitting in the ADL's eye, and Donald Trump winning the election, and so on. I don't say that I like the new establishment, but there is a new establishment. And the old establishment is on the back foot. And there is, you know, when there is a question of, well, now you have to explain yourself. That is the question that the sort of the old establishment gets. They have to explain themselves. You know, there's a power dynamic here where they are the junior partner in this society now, where they sort of have to explain themselves to their superiors. And it's not just that it's widely known. It's just that there are so many people talking about these things now. It's become so widespread. You can't really deplatform everyone. And a society that is built entirely on, you know, where everyone just pays lip service to the system and no one really believes it anymore, it doesn't really work. I mean, even the Soviet Union was sort of fell apart because it was fake. You know, everyone pretended to believe in this ideology that no one really believed in anymore. I mean, back in Lenin's time, they did. They were fanatics. They were true believers. But they weren't in the later generations, you know. And so when you have an entire society that just pays lip service to something, then it will start to collapse. And there is also the factor of, for example, with Elon Musk taking over Twitter, if he just allows perhaps too much free speech because it just turns into chaos, at least if the other platforms that are competing, they have a completely different set of rules it doesn't really work because there has to be, there's a sort of a natural equilibrium between the platforms, whereas maybe one leans a little bit more this way, the other leans a little bit more that way, but there will develop a certain kind of equilibrium. And so I just think that the sort of the cat is out of the bag, and, you know, people with 100 times or 1,000 times bigger platforms than you and I talk about these issues. It wouldn't make sense to even attack people who are not as influential. You know, there's a sort of a question of what makes sense to do in this situation. So I think that the old establishment, which has now sort of given way to the new establishment, they've realized that that battle is lost. So they have to adapt. They have to try to co-opt, perhaps, and try to sort of derail this reaction in a direction that is less harmful to them and their power. But to just stop it head on, I don't think that's possible anymore. I think there has been a genuine fundamental shift where they have been forced to adapt, not because they want to, but because that's how power works. Power has a sort of an impersonal quality, where it's like a historical force, you know, where you can't just ignore it. It's a sort of it's a zeitgeist. It's a spirit of the times. This is just what people take for granted now. When I go to my barber, he starts talking to me about the things that maybe you and I talked about 10 years ago. You know, I mean, just the random people that you run into day to day, this is now taken for granted in their everyday conversations, and it's no longer taboo even because it's so obvious. And there's a sense in which also, you know, this is part of why America has a difficult time combating anti-Zionist feelings, you know, criticism of Israel in America right now. It's because the country is largely non-white. It's only white people who adhere to these taboos and who are guilt-tripped into obeying and bending the knee. The black people, the Asians, the Mexicans, who are now becoming a minority, who are already a majority in the younger generation, they don't give a shit. They're not going to be guilt-tripped about anything that happened in the Second World War in Europe. They don't care. I mean, there's a sense in which when this sort of high trust society collapses, the elites and the people in power, they lose their tool for controlling society, because it is the high trust function of people willingly going along with things because it's expected of them. That's the polite thing to do, and so on. When all of that falls apart, it's more difficult to police what people do and think and say, because all that structure that keeps society orderly has gone away. And so there's a sense in which there is this, it is this golem. And I don't mean to imply that it's just like Jews in power at the top, but it is this golem. It is this, the ruling class has created this political system and this society that they've lost control over. And so there is a sense in which they can't control it anymore, even if they want to.
It's fascinating, isn't it? I guess what their idea was, well, we don't need civic trust and homogeneity and so on, because what we'll have is a rules-based order. And that, I think that was their big idea. Like, if I think of Tony Blair and his ilk, I think this was their great hope, that it would be a rules-based order. People would just obey the rules. You don't need traditions or commonality or whatever. As long as there are rules and people know them, and for whatever reason obey them. Well, what if they don't? Now, during COVID, I noticed this myself. When I visited Scotland, it was far more the people were far more adherent to the COVID rules than people else, like in London, for example, because London is so multicultural that there's no inclination for people to do their bit for their fellow man. And it's also very difficult to make them do their bit for their fellow, because it doesn't matter to them. Why should some Pakistani care about some African and feel any obligation to them? So So that is one thing. And to back that up, and it's really interesting. If you think about a schoolroom in Germany, 20 years ago, that schoolroom would have been full of white German children. Yeah. And you could tell them what their grandfathers did in the Holocaust to 6 million Jews. And those children would be ashamed. They'd feel terrible to their core. It would really make them hate being German and yet feel a huge obligation to the rest of the world because they are German, etc. You can see where I'm going.
Yeah.
That schoolroom today has a lot of Turks in it and a lot of Africans in it. And when they're hearing this stuff about the Holocaust, and not just the Holocaust, also just the whole world, the whole Third Reich.
Yeah.
What guilt can you possibly make them feel about that? It has nothing to do with them. Their grandparents weren't involved in it. And by the way, this takes for granted that an ethnic group is a thing. Otherwise, why should the white German kids feel any guilt for what they're at? You know, it's interesting. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like the Irish thing. You know, why? Okay, so Irish people emigrated. So then why should Irish people who remain in Ireland accept newcomers? Unless they have an obligation that was created by the other Irish people.
Yeah.
It takes for the Irish people must be a real thing in order for that obligation to carry over at all.
Yeah.
But it's the same with the German kids and the new German kids.
Why?
That's the problem. Those new German kids are not really German because you don't expect, nobody expects them to feel any guilt about the Holocaust. No one.
And it's not only that they're not, that these stories from what European peoples or German people supposedly did 3 generations ago or 80 years ago or 100 years ago, is not only that that's not relevant to them personally, there's also a, shall we say, racial personality type. There's an ethnic personality type where the more Northwestern European you are, the more you can be made to feel guilty and feel shameful about things, whereas other people don't have that mechanism. You can't really, it's sort of like sort of Gandhi's passive resistance type of things. Let's just allow them to beat us until they feel so much shame that they stop. That wouldn't work in Israel. That's not going to work for the Palestinians because, you know, frankly, the people beating them up are never going to feel shame or guilt about it. So there's a sort of an element here that this egalitarianism, it doesn't work in practice because other people can't be forced to have these feelings and to feel shame and guilt and so on. That makes their societies different. I mean, there's a good thing about guilt and shame in a society because it creates a high functioning society. People feel, you know, responsibility for what they do. I saw this report in some newspaper or whatever where they talked about the problems with Generation Z and the younger generations, where when they enter the workforce, they don't really have a sense of responsibility anymore. They don't have this kind of sense of responsibility for doing a job for their employer and so on. Where you know, if I don't do my job, then someone else is going to suffer. They have been raised in a much more individualistic culture where it's, you know, it's all about me. And you know, it's not their fault. I'm just saying that when those qualities go out of society, it has consequences. For example, things stop working because people don't really feel. And this is a difference between Western Europe and Eastern Europe. If you go to Eastern Europe, things don't work as well because people don't have that feeling of responsibility to their society in general. They are usually much more resentful toward their society, or sort of they see it as a, I don't know, like an oppressive structure or something, but they don't have this sense. I mean, it's a gradual difference, of course. It's not black and white. I'm just saying there is a difference in culture, and So, you know, when those qualities go out of society, when they disappear, it has consequences. Things stop working. They don't work as well.
Well, this is the kind of thing that it's astonishing that this kind of thing wasn't taken into account, you know, 50 years ago when the whole multiculturalism project was launched, when mass immigration was made into a thing. It's incredible that no one thought, well, hold on a minute, this is going to really change our societies. I mean, maybe, obviously, I'm sure that the engineers at the top knew that full well. But what's amazing is that politicians came out in public and said, this won't change our societies. How can that possibly be true? How could it possibly be true?
Well, I mean, the thing is, the thing is that this is the problem with a certain type of conspiracy theories, right? A certain type of conspiracy theory suggests that the people at the top are sort of cynical planners, that they're not true believers. But the thing is that many times throughout history, the people creating these situations have been true believers. They've actually believed their own bullshit. And so that's been sort of, that's created their own destruction because they've actually implemented, you know, it's like if, take the, just like a simple everyday example, the Democratic Party in America, they obviously actually believed in affirmative action, in having, you know, instead of having like a qualified person running for president, they had someone filling a quota of being a woman and being black. That was their qualification. I mean, obviously these people, they wouldn't put forth a candidate that they want to lose. I mean, I don't believe that. It's obvious that they believe their own bullshit. And so they lost because they implemented their own policies. And so in many ways, I mean, sometimes there are cynical planners at the top, but very often people just believe their own ideology. They believe their own propaganda. You know, I mean, there are many, many mistakes are made this way. Another example from recent times, it's clear to me that, for example, when Russia invaded Ukraine, the Russian leadership, they believe that Ukrainians aren't really a separate thing. They're really Russians who just speak with a different dialect or something. And when we come, we'll be welcomed with flowers, basically. And so we can liberate this country in 3 days. And it seems clear to me that, you know, Putin and the other leaders of Russia, they actually believed some version of that story that they tell to their own people. But then they encountered a very different reality. And now they're, you know, in a huge war. That's just another example. My point is that a lot of people who push propaganda actually believe their own propaganda. And so that's, you know, it's not always that they're very clever, cynical players. It's just that they're actually true believers. You know, Lenin was a true believer. By all accounts, Lenin was a true believer in this kind of utopian communism that you can treat society as this machine, as an engineer, you can plan it and you'll have these perfect results and so on. It's a crazy idea, but by all accounts, he actually believed it.
Yeah, I can believe that he believed in it. But what about his funders? That's the thing. Sure. That's what I mean when I say the engineers. I mean the World Bank and high finance and so on. I doubt that they thought communism would be pleasant for anyone, and I also doubt that they thought mass immigration, multiculturalism would be great for anyone. I think they knew damn well that this is going to be a living hell for the Russians, and this is going to destroy the West with multiculturalism.
I think you're right. I mean, this is important to not treat them, the sort of the big quote unquote they, as this monolithic thing, because of course there are individuals who see mass immigration as a type of punishment. You know, it's a sort of a what Nietzsche calls a sort of a slave revolt. You know, this society has made me feel bad about myself. Now I have to punish this society. I'm going to get back at them. There's a lot of that in sort of gay pride parades. You know, people who feel like they don't fit in. This society doesn't accept me. I'm going to show them. I'm going to fucking show them. And so they're going to like be vulgar, disgusting, do things and so on. And there's a lot of policy, and there's a lot of attitudes that are driven by spite, no doubt about it. So there's absolutely, there's the combination of ill will, of ill will, and actual sort of true believer utopianism and so on. That's what makes it a complicated problem or a complex problem. It's not like this one monolith. It's not like one guy making all the decisions and having like magical control. It's like a society is a complex thing with hundreds of, I mean, if we talk about Europe, it's like hundreds of millions of people. And even in the power elite, if we talk about the power elite as perhaps the top 1 million people or the top 100,000 people, all of them are not going to agree about everything. There is disagreement, vast disagreement within the elite. I mean, I don't have a doubt in my mind that the old establishment actually hated Donald Trump and Elon Musk and so on. There's no doubt in my mind that that's a genuine thing. But now they've been forced to sort of tolerate and adapt. So there are these disagreements as well. So the sort of the people running society, that's not a monolithic thing.
Oh, no, indeed. And this is something that we've been talking about. I mean, other people have been talking about it forever, but in our circles, we've been talking about it since COVID 2020, this sense that there was the Zionist Wall Street Pentagon, and then there was Silicon Valley, the UN, the World Economic Forum. And those two power blocks seemed to be in some ways at loggerheads. So when you say the old establishment and the new establishment, can you define those in your own terms?
That's a good question. I mean, the old establishment is clearly the what we have largely loosely called the sort of the cosmopolitan left, which is the progressivist. They've implemented the woke thing in the last couple of decades. It's been more focused on egalitarianism. There is this struggle between, you know, the two ruling ideologies after the Second World War. You have equality and individual freedom, right? And of course, Soviet Union was more focused on equality, right? Everyone has to be the same, whereas America is more focused on individualism. I think that there was definitely a sort of a movement in America that through cultural Marxism and so on, the sort of second generation Frankfurt School, Herbert Marcuse and so on, they definitely implemented this type of cultural Marxism in the intellectual culture. I think that it has largely lost to this more individualist capitalist, sort of hardcore individualist capitalist ideology of people like Donald Trump and so on. So they, instead of trying to implement this kind of identity politics where sort of, well, you guys, black people are victims, transsexual people are victims, you know, like left has always had this client group. It used to be poor people or the working class, the proletariat. Oh, we're your representatives. We're going to use this victim group as a battering ram to gain power in society and to change society and so on. Well, they realized that the working class was not a very obedient and good victim group. So they switched over to racial minorities and ethnic minorities and sexual minorities and other kind of victim groups, even handicapped people and so on. And it seems like that old identity politics type of elite, those kinds of utopian ideas that we're going to create this equal society, they've lost out to the more individualist capitalist version because they've run out of steam. They have nothing left to give. You know, I mean, we saw this even years ago. I started talking about, and other people started talking about, well, it seems like they're, you know, like the gay pride celebrations every summer. They're just going through the motions now. It used to be like quite a big thing. Now it's kind of died down. It's not fun for them anymore. People don't care. It's sort of become old hat, right? Yeah. So it seems like that old identity politics establishment has run out of steam, and we're now in a more hardcore capitalist individualist mode, where the way to deal with racial differences isn't to say that, well, since you are black, you're going to get reparations and you're going to get back at whitey. Instead, it's like, look, we're like Carl Weathers and Arnold Schwarzenegger. We're going to be pals. We're going to be sidekicks in this sort of Eddie Murphy 48 hours type of thing. We're all going to get along now because we're all individuals. We're all going to win. And so there is more of that. And that also requires that we have less of this repressive, really Soviet-style totalitarianism, suppressing what you can say and think. It's like, well, come on, we can all get along. It's a different flavor of ideology. Are you there?
Sorry, yeah, I was just trying to locate that image for you, because I thought it was quite funny. Hold on a second. It's a sort of iconic image that has been shared around an awful lot. So I'll just get that and put it up on screen for people so that they know what it is we're talking about. Hold on a second. There we go. That.
Yeah. And it's like, really, yeah. it's really, you know, also Arnold is the main character. The white guy is the main character. The black guy is his good friend, his cool sidekick, but it is a sidekick. The main character is still white. And it's the same thing with Donald Trump. He does have, you know, Kash Patel and other people as sidekicks. And it's like, we can all win. We can all be cool together. And, you know, we can all be winners. But there is, you know, Mark Weber, I've never looked at Star Trek, so maybe I'm the wrong person to talk about this analogy. But Mark Weber has often talked about the division that the post-war Americans have is like the Star Trek spaceship, where you have all kinds of different species, but really it's the American white person that is the captain of the ship, in a way. You know, it's like we can just create this utopian society where everyone just gets along as winners, as individuals, but really, you know, it's like a person like Donald Trump who is sort of the captain of the ship, but everyone else is cool as well. And so there's no ill will between the different groups. There's no way to, you're not going to get reparations. You're not going to get any of that. And it's easier. It's more palatable for white people to go along with that. You know, it's easier to get people to accept that stuff.
It is. But at the same time, a lot of white people would be annoyed if Geordie LaForge went off with a 7 of 9. You know, like I know that those are two different series of Star Trek, but nonetheless, it's like this race-blind civic nationalism sort of rests on the idea that we will stay separate, though. I mean, we'll be friends, we'll live in the same neighborhoods even, and yet black men won't approach white women.
That's implicit, perhaps, in what a lot of people imagine. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like once that starts happening, the whole thing becomes much more real. Yeah, but anyway, here's a question. I agree that the individualist thing is winning out. People are just not galvanized or excited by wokery and all of that. Because it's actually a very miserable sort of ideology. It's constantly browbeating everyone. It's making the client groups feel like weak, pathetic victims, and it's making white people feel guilty or they resent that it's trying to make them feel guilty all the time. So that is a miserable ideology. It's now apparently dying out to some extent. I actually think it's not going to die out completely at all. I see signs of it still now. Almost every day there are new examples of it. It's not disappearing. Maybe that will happen in time. I don't know. But either way, it is clearly to some extent giving way to a more individualistic ethos. So my question would be, what does that mean for us, for nationalists?
I agree that it's not going away. It's just that it's like I said, it's the junior partner. So if we have like these two ideologies ruling the world together, ruling the West together, like who is the superior and who is the inferior player here? It's not that the other party is going to go away. I don't believe that. But I do believe that they're losing the power to sort of browbeat other people with their sort of miserable ideology. And in a way, it is this sort of libertarianism it's more pleasant to deal with, because I mean it's more pleasant to deal with someone who is an individualist, who is more actually tolerant of like discussing things that he maybe disagrees with and so on. I mean, there's a sense in which it's less oppressive, it's less totalitarian and sort of less in your face and so on. So I think that, you know, a part of it that's positive is that it's more comfortable to live under such circumstances. Like I said, the sort of cancel culture, I think maybe it's not going away 100%, but it's definitely weaker now. And I don't think it's just a temporary change. I think it is like society has changed on a fundamental level, so that type of cancel culture has the power of it has been reduced significantly. But on the negative side, of course, it's more difficult to deal with. You know, Blackpilled, our good friend, he brought up this example that after Donald Trump won the election, whereas, you know, before the election, a huge part of society had a mistrust. They distrusted the electoral system and the sort of political system and so on. Now everyone trusts it. Now it's like, I don't know, like 10% or something, you know. So that's like turned on its head, because their guy won or whatever. Now everyone trusts the system. So there is a sense in which I think on the negative side, it's going to be more difficult to mobilize any serious opposition, because people start letting their guard down and, you know, things are moving more and more in our direction and so on. People aren't very ideological, you know. I mean, people are, they have a sort of instincts that are flawed, but they follow their instincts. They don't think things through. I mean, it's, you know, a lot of people feel more comfortable. Now we're talking about America, but since that's the example that everyone knows, but a lot of people feel more comfortable when the face leading their country is Donald Trump rather than Barack Obama, because one is black and the other is white. And it seems like, oh, well, our guys are still leading the thing. And so, you know, we're still in charge here, even if that might not be true. But that's the sort of the impression that people get. So I think while we're going to get a freer debate, at least for now, for the foreseeable future, I believe that. I also believe that it's going to be more difficult to get people actually engaged and involved in creating any fundamental change. It's like, you know,
I think that's true in America, but I think that the economic situation in Europe means that I don't think it will be more difficult, because I think people are going to, they're going to be pissed off, and especially if they keep seeing migrants being bussed into their towns. I mean, if that doesn't stop, people are going to be fucking furious.
Yeah. No, I agree. I agree. I'm not that black-pilled, really. There's a sense in which it is true for America, but there's also like the Rammstein song, you know, we're all living in America, Coca-Cola, sometimes war. We're all living sort of still in America's shadow. Politically, culturally, and so it is going to affect Europe to a large extent. But it also, I believe, that America will become less powerful, both as a political and military entity, but also as a cultural entity. And so, I think really, it's at least the discourse, public discourse, opening up is going to be beneficial, because it's simply a fact that things that you and I talked about many years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, which only reached a few people, you know, maybe, I don't know how many people will watch this conversation between us, but maybe it's a couple of, maybe it's a couple of thousand or 2,000-3,000. I don't know. But then again, you know, some people, some of those people, they're not just people who just sit there and then do nothing. Some of those people have their own reach and, you know, talking points trickle down and they maybe spread them to 100,000 people. What do I know? You know, I mean, there is a sense in which this trickle down effect is real. Talking points that people like you and I would have made 20 years ago now reach mainstream audience. That's just a fact. And there are positive aspects of that. Now, I don't believe that, you know, people are rational creatures in the sense that they just hear a logical argument and they think, oh, that's true. That will just automatically, magically change society. But I do think it's a starting point. Metapolitics is real. Metapolitics works not because it's... Here's what I mean. If you reach, say that there are, you know, a few people, a handful, say that in a hypothetical sort of society, 10 people are powerful. If you reach, you know, 100 people, or if you reach 100,000 people, or if you reach 10 million people, you know, the more people you reach, the higher the likelihood that one of the people you reach are going to be some of the powerful people. You know what I mean? So that it's not just that, you know, all of a sudden there'll be this spontaneous change in society, but some of the people listening to us, maybe they go to Davos. What do I know? You know, I mean, it's we reach intelligent people, and intelligent people have political potential. You know, they have potential to change society. And that's really what it's all about. You know, metapolitics, that's the name of the game. That's what I believe in. I did the spring conference in the spring of 2023, where I gave a speech, other people gave speeches. And it didn't take long until I heard the very, like, sometimes literally the phrase that I said, like, heard other people saying it, like, just a week after. And then a month after that, probably people saying it who had never seen my original speech, but they've heard other people who repeated it. And so there's a thing, there's like a rings on the water, there's a ripple effect, right? And so there's a sense in which with this opened up free speech, there is a chance that a more sensible understanding of the world will reach people who are actually powerful.
That's very optimistic, and I agree with you. And I think this is why we do what we do. I mean, it's one of the reasons, as well as being of intellectual interest, and as well as providing solidarity with like-minded people, there is also the goal of reaching new people, and especially influential people.
Of course.
If we weren't doing that, this whole thing would be kind of futile. It would be a self-help group, and I don't want it to be that. I certainly don't want it to be just that. No. I want us to be thinking about really changing society, because God knows it needs to be changed.
Yeah.
You said that you think America will be less, I think you said influential or less powerful. Mm-hmm. Can't remember which word you used. Why do you think that is, given that, you know, Trump is, because some people would say, well, Trump's going to be in, he's aiming to emulate the 80s, so it's going to be yuppies and, you know, models. I'm thinking Gordon about Bob Morton in RoboCop with the cocaine and all that. In fact, I can probably find a very amusing image to illustrate the kind of thing that America might be heading towards. But if that is the case, then, well, why do you think that America will be less influential and powerful? Here's the image that I was thinking of. Anyway, yeah, to be serious, take it away.
Well, because he's going to fail. That's the short answer. He's not going to make America great again. You know, my good colleague, Mark Weber, I want to give him credit with this analogy. He said that thinking that you're going to make America great again, like turning back the time to when America was on its way up or at the top, it's like thinking for a Brit to say that we're going to create the British Empire again. It's not going to happen. It's fantasy fiction. He can bring up an old has-been Hulk Hogan on stage as much as he likes, he's not going to turn back time to the 80s. It's already done. It's already over. You cannot turn back time to the 80s whenever you think that, well, things were great. It's not going to happen. So the short answer is he's not going to make America great again. It's impossible, just like it's impossible to create the British Empire again, or when Sweden was a great power and ruled St. Petersburg. That's not going to happen again. You know, I mean, Sweden is not going to become a great power that makes the Baltic Sea a lake inside of Sweden again. That's not going to happen. And America is not going to become great again. America is not going to return to 1965 demographic makeup. It's not going to happen. People have already seen and lost a lot of respect for what America can. America can have some power still by fear and by just sheer raw power. Say that, well, if you don't, like Donald Trump said, if you don't salute the dollar, we're going to punish you with tariffs and so on. Yeah, he can do that. He can threaten. But there's a sense in which America has lost its cultural credibility, which it once had. It's gravity, really. And so it's increasingly America is becoming this sort of Idi Amin superpower with it's like a child with a machine gun or something like that. You know, yeah, people are afraid, but they don't really respect you, you know, and unfortunately, because I mean, I'm not anti-American in any fundamental way. And I love America as a country. There's a lot of cool things in American popular culture. You know, there's a lot of American people, individuals that I respect, but their political culture is bankrupt. It doesn't have any credibility anymore. So that's why I don't think it's going to regain any of this, this power. Donald Trump is not going to make America great again. It's just going to continue on this trajectory. Some people are going to be in denial for a couple of years, and then they're going to say, then they're going to become more cynical. America is still going to be a rich country, still going to have a powerful military, and still going to produce, you know, Hollywood stuff, but it doesn't have the same weight as it did, in the past. And also Donald Trump is increasingly harming. I mean, he's a good businessman, but in many ways an idiot politician. I mean, he's harming every relationship he has with every ally he has. That's not intelligent. I mean, like taunting, mocking the Canadians. I mean, what the hell? That's like, he's an idiot. He's just like a spoiled child. He's just harming every diplomatic relationship he has, except with Israel. And increasingly, the rest of the world just has contempt for Israel. It's only America that still supports them, you know, except for some like weird little island somewhere that, you know, in some other part of the world. But really, the civilized world doesn't have any respect for that. And increasingly, the civilized world doesn't have any respect for America's political class. Again, I mean, I don't want to be like too harsh on America, because I like America in many ways, but the American political class is done. It doesn't have any credibility.
I agree. If you think about the figure of Hillary Clinton, or of course Joe Biden, or of course Kamala Harris, it just seems like an array of clowns, or absolute fools and jokers. Morons, yeah. Really. And then you've got the fact that so much of it is geriatric. So, I mean, why is it all these old men? Why is it ridiculous? And I've said this last year, and I've said it maybe this year as well, but I really think it's just not right. It's just not healthy for a nation to be governed or heavily, predominantly influenced by old people. It should be people in their 40s, 50s, and 30s, but not people in their 70s and 80s. That is farcical. It's ridiculous. Yeah. And because the thing is, yes, of course they have wisdom. They have wisdom about people, but their wisdom about society goes out of date. You know,
yeah.
And this is what everyone says about the boomers. You know, yeah, they're wise about how you should treat that friend, or how you should treat that lover, or what you should do in this marriage, or whatever. But when it comes to society, they're completely they don't know what they're talking about. And I think it's the same with the geriatric politicians and whatever in America. It's absolutely ridiculous. It's morbid.
Yeah.
But that's only one aspect of the general corruption of American politics, because it's always been that way. But yeah. You've also got the someone like Hillary Clinton, who is utterly corrupt. I don't know how anyone could take her seriously and respect her and think her a good person. She's the scum of the earth. Absolutely evil woman. And then you've got the wokery, which they all invested in. I mean, Joe Biden was telling people to get their trans kids and get them the care they need, which, and we all know what that means. I mean, it's to the butcher shop. It's appalling. But the thing is, you can laugh at the wokery and that term and trivialize and say it's silly. It's a real thing. Joe Biden nailed his colors to that. What was the term? Nailed your colors to the mast. Whatever.
To the mast. Yeah.
He invested in that. Yeah. And so did Kamala. And so did Hillary to a great extent. And I'm sure Barack Obama would have as well. And even the cucked Republicans. I mean, how many of them could... But what all of this means, and this to talk about the woke thing in itself, and I think this is relevant to what we were saying earlier, when you can't define a woman, everyone knows that you are beyond... that you cannot be respected. You cannot be...
You're fake.
You are living either in a world of delusion or deceit. It's one or the other.
Yeah.
You're either not being honest with yourself or you're not being honest with everyone else, or maybe both.
Yeah.
You might as well be an insane person. If you can't say what a woman is, you've got nothing to offer. And that, I think, is how... And the thing is, it's not just the crazy professors or the activists who are saying this. It was also the political establishment. And again, with Afghanistan and the feminism and the gay murals, the LGBT, I mean, to think that the Taliban, these men on camels, would be amenable to that, it's like, how tone deaf could you be? You might as well be the 20-year-old fresh out of a gender studies degree who knows nothing about the real world whatsoever, and yet that was the world's superpower doing that. Incredible.
No, I think you make a very good point about the age thing here. And, you know, I mean, you and I, as millennials, there's a sense in which you cannot get out of the sort of mental image of the world as it was when you came of age. It's like maybe you and I are a little bit out of touch to people who grew up in the Zoomer generation, right? Or the Generation Alpha, because we grew up in a completely different society. Society has changed a lot since the 80s, 90s, when we came of age. And so maybe we're a little bit out of touch now. Well, imagine a person like Donald Trump or Joe Biden who came of age, I don't know when, like in the 50s, 60s. So in a sense, Joe Biden is living in a mental world where white people are still the dominant majority in America. It's America's still really a white country, and like you have to be nice to like black people because they're, you know, you're sort of like the shepherd, you know, watching over your flock in a sense. That's not how the world is anymore. But I think that's how a lot of these sort of left-leaning politicians, especially the people who grew up in an era when white people were still the dominant, by far dominant population in America before the 1965 immigration reform. And so I think that's also just a sign of a society in collapse and decline, is that they're ruled by just old people who are out of touch with society. They don't know the society that they are governing. I think the same was true in the Soviet Union. You know, they had also a very old ruling class, and the ruling class becomes like a clique of friends. I'm not saying it's a monolithic group, but it's a group that sort of runs society. And so they kind of promote each other and so on, but they're really out of touch with society. And, you know, this could be both in terms of age, but also in terms of class. I mean, these politicians are ridiculously wealthy compared with the average person. So they live in a completely different reality. It's like they cannot they kind of relate to the lives that normal people have, especially in a country like America or like Russia, the Soviet Union, you know, like where the ruling class is extremely wealthy and powerful. Normal people have nothing. And it's like Donald Trump was riding that wave, you know, normal people feel left out, but really he doesn't represent normal people. He's just more honest about it, I guess. He's just more straightforward about it. But, you know, it is different from countries, you know, smaller countries in Europe, for example, where the ruling class is more normal people in a way. There isn't the same type of extreme class difference between the ruling class and so on. So I'm not saying that but I'm just saying that the difference is bigger in these enormous countries with hundreds of millions of people where, you know, the ruling class is extremely wealthy and extremely old. And sort of, so you get this, that kind of tension between the ruling class, the rulers and the ruled. It's multiplied. That sort of difference is multiplied in a bigger society like in America. And the age difference, the sort of geriatric ruling class it's absolutely one of the problems. You know, we have this, what's it called? Mitch something, the guy who's like froze, like, and he's like just frozen.
That was
like terrible to watch. Oh. It looks horrific. He's like an old guy. Looked like he died, you know? And it's like, you know how old people have like this skin that gets like shiny? It's like we have like a structure in our skin. But like when people get very old, like in their 90s or like 100 years old, it's like their skin gets like really smooth and shiny. And that's just a terrible image. And that's like, that guy should be nowhere near power. I'm not saying he's a bad person, but it's not a good idea to have him in any position of power.
Yeah, I'm going to actually try to get that clip of because it feels so, it was so strange. I'll see if I can download it and play it for people. And by the way, I've had relatives who've had dementia. I've had three relatives who've had dementia. So
I'm not trying to mock them, but it's like,
I've got no interest. I mean, this is not a novelty to me or whatever. And I don't take it lightly. But for this to be someone in the government or to have any influence, really, any political influence, I don't know. It feels very dangerous, frankly. I found the clip. I'll just upload it now. And of course, right, well, here we go. I can just play it. Oh, no, I can't. Sorry.
We did see him, at least.
Yeah, we could see him, but that's not quite what I wanted. Let's see. It's... Okay. Right, there we go. That one. Let's see what's going on here. Oh, there we go. Right, okay. Yeah. Sorry about this, everyone. It's better if this stuff can happen very dynamically. I mean, it's always a bit of a bummer when you have to stop everything. Let me see. This might not work. Well, let's see.
Yeah, try.
No, it doesn't work. Sorry.
No. That's how he looks in the moving picture as well.
Yeah. Well, anyway, he just exactly. Someone said, "Cue Windows error message." Yeah. It's a very strange thing indeed, and he's giving this press conference, and somebody asks a question, and he just freezes, he just stops, and I don't know whether it was ever. I mean, this was a year ago. I don't know whether anyone. Yeah, it was July last year, so I don't know whether it was ever diagnosed what happened here, whether it was a stroke or a mini stroke, or I don't. No one seems to know. For that to happen with a very prominent political figure. But it's the same thing with Biden. I mean, we don't need to enumerate all the things that happened, all these weird gaffes and moments. But then it was the same even with Hillary during her election campaign. People forget this, but in 2016, she was having bizarre episodes. There was one where somebody was talking to her and she just started looking all over the place. I mean, it was surreal.
Yeah, there was someone who wrote, you remember when she had a coughing fit And someone wrote a limerick about it. There was an old gal named Hillary. She used to cough like a barrage of artillery and so on. It's the funniest thing. It's the funniest thing I've ever read. It was just someone wrote it as a comment somewhere. It was just the funniest limerick ever. But yeah, I remember she was in bad shape as well. She collapsed. It's like her bodyguards had to like lift her up and put her in the limousine.
Yeah, there was that incident where they had, and the thing is, they always try to cover up and deny that there was anything wrong at all. And I think eventually they did say, yeah, the stress of the election campaign is getting to her, but she is fine. But it was, I mean, they were literally sort of, it's so ridiculous to describe it, but it was on, there's the footage, you can find it, Hillary Clinton van. And, you know, by the way, if she was a nice person, I wouldn't be taking any pleasure in this at all. But I think she's a genuinely evil woman.
Oh, yeah, she's a sadist.
Yeah. And the two, like, bouncers or whatever, security guys were sort of heaving her into the back of the van. Just absolutely ridiculous. But anyway, so to get back to more serious matters, that. I think you're right, because what we were talking about was America, the chances for America. Now, I like the idea of a return to the 80s. I get a certain thrill from that. I think it was cool. It's kind of sexy. It would be fun, and it would be nice for Americans to be prosperous. I've got loads of American friends. You know, some of my best friends are American.
Exactly.
So I want the best for them. But at the same time, oh, first of all, comfort isn't necessarily good for us in this day and age.
It really isn't.
Complacency and all that. But also, I do agree with you that I think it will be a fairly superficial return to the 80s.
Of course.
I think there will be prosperity. I think there will be more patriotism, pride in America. And I do think that the wokery will be put away to some extent, and there will be more relaxed. I think the anti-white stuff will probably disappear to a great extent, if not completely, to a great extent.
Yeah.
Over time, I think over the course of this presidency, the question really is. But even then, I don't think it will be total, and I don't think that America will really recover, because, as you say, there is a certain momentum to things, and there's only so much that you can fake it till you make it and just pretend that, hey, I'm in my 20s again. You're not. And, you know, America could be energetic again, like ebb and flow, but it takes a long time to get back to that so that you're genuinely in that condition again. There has to be the ebb and flow, the rejuvenation and all this. I don't think you can just will it into being.
No.
I'd love it if you could. I'd really love that. But as it is, I don't think you can. And certainly not. You see, this is the thing that really precludes it. It's conceivable that you could do that, but not with the demographics of America today, because America's demographics today are not those of 1980. Therefore, you're not going to have the 80s that it went on to have. Yeah. That's the starting point, is a heavily non-white population. So that alone, even without just looking at the IQ, the capabilities of the population, without even going into the tensions and the resentments and confusion between multiple cultures and all that, even just looking at the raw IQ potential, it's not the population of 1980.
No, you can't undo this change. I mean, there's a sense in which, you know, remigration, like hypothetically, could happen in Europe. Like if we take Sweden as an example, all of the demographic change, really, the sort of mass immigration, has happened in the last 30 years. You know, like since the late 80s, early 90s, that's when like this stuff really happened. In America, it's been going on for centuries. I mean, they've had like a large black population for centuries. there's no like realistic way for that to happen. And so there's a sense in which it just is what it is now. And you have to work with that. And maybe, you know, Trump can get some like economic things back on track. I don't even know that. But that's not really the area I care much about, because in racial terms, in terms of getting back to like a homeland, it's just not going to happen. You know, whatever economic policies where everyone can be a winner and everyone salutes the dollar and whatever Trump talks about, that doesn't really change the fundamental problem here. And what's more, it doesn't, he and his administration, the people running the show, don't even want it to happen. You know, there's a lot of projection, and especially in not only in America, in Europe as well, people project their own wishful thinking upon their national populist political party of choice, right? So they say, oh, well, I hope this will happen. Well, they get sort of close to some of the things that I like. And so I'm just going to start hoping that they're going to do the thing that I want. But the fact is, you know, Elon Musk and the others, they want to increase immigration, just legal immigration. And, you know, diversity can actually work as long as you don't let those criminals in. You know, they have this delusional idea. Donald Trump says all the time as well, I want more immigration. We're just going to, you know, have the legal, the right kind and so on. And it's they're stuck in the same paradigm that created the problem to begin with. You're not going to solve the problem. Yeah, you're not going to solve the problem from that paradigm. You need to break the paradigm. That's a metapolitical process. That metapolitical process takes generations. I've said for many, many, many years, I've said it's similar to like when the Roman Empire converted to Christianity. It's a process that took centuries, really, because you have to create a complete shift in the worldview of the people, right? And that's what's going to be needed. And, you know, there's no way to predict exactly how that's going to work, but I just don't like when people get their hopes up about any kind of quick fix, because there is no quick fix. It's not possible. You're not going to have a quick fix. So don't get your hopes up about it. I said this already back in, you know, 2015, all these political candidates, you know, you can support them for the change they create in discourse and so on. But then when they're actually in power, they're not going to do anything. And we see that again and again and again with all, not in America only, but in national populist parties in Europe. When they get a certain kind of power, they just get too watered down. They become toothless. They become useless. And they don't really do anything, but they do have an effect in the sense that they do change discourse. They do create a sort of an environment, social environment where people can talk about the issues. And that's a starting point. I mean, we can't hope for miracles. This is a problem. It's a disaster. We're like in a disaster. There's not going to be you're not going to push a button or, you know, take a magic pill and solve the whole thing. It's like, it's going to be a long process, and you have to be able to do it year after year after year and generation after generation. Get out of it.
I've got the clip of Mitch McConnell. I knew I realized what I was doing something wrong. I was being too hasty. So here it is.
After finishing the NDAA this week, it's been good bipartisan cooperation and a string of
Okay, Mitch. Anything else you want to say? Or should we just go back to your office? Mm-hmm. Do you want to say anything else to the press?
Go ahead, John.
Let's go back to
you.
Go ahead, John.
So how about that?
Oh. fucking hell. I mean, it's scary as well. It's really terrifying to see that, you know, because, you know, we're all frail creatures really at the end of the day. And even the people in power, I mean, I don't really know much about that guy. So I'm not going to like make fun of him, but it's just a society that seems to systematically get those kinds of people to the top. Seems like that type of society has a problem, is all I'm saying.
Yeah, somebody's saying he needs more adrenochrome. Maybe. So here, to wrap this up, before we get to the super chats, which I won't forget, I think you're right that we're in for some more freedom of speech.
Yeah.
It's possible that there was this whole thing that Trump promised, he said that he was going to implement laws to just disallow the banning of people for political reasons from social media. Yeah. He went into it in some depth. It was a speech that he gave, a video that he put up that lasted about 8 minutes. And he goes into it very thoroughly in that time about all the things that he's going to do. Yeah. But I thought it was new, but then I realized that it was actually from 2 years ago. Right. So it might well have forgotten all about it by now. Who knows? But either way, I just think that his general attitude is going to lead to more freedom of speech. And as you said, Elon Musk with Twitter, they're going to have to compete with that to some extent. They can't just have a complete disparity where all the right-wing people are on Twitter and everyone else is everywhere else. It's just ridiculous. Yeah. So I think you're right. There's going to be more freedom of speech. But the big question is, what happens 4 years from now? Because it could well be that they just do all of this again. It's like 2020 all over again, where I don't mean COVID, but I mean this entrance into just uber wokery and censorship everywhere, and to undo everything that he's done in his 4 years. And after all, who is going to replace him? I can't see. I mean, maybe there is. I'm not that well up on American politics, but I can't see anyone who would be a fitting replacement for Donald Trump. What do you think? I mean, obviously, I'm not asking you to predict what is going to happen 4 years from now, but I'm sure you can understand these concerns.
Yeah, for sure. You know, in some ways, I think it's two different questions. I mean, what's going to happen, like, in terms of party politics? Who's going to take out over after Donald Trump? Maybe it's going to be J.D. Vance and his Indian wife with the sort of high caste immigration and so on. So that's one thing. But I think that's sort of a separate question from the shift that has happened in popular culture and in discourse in general with and we talked about this when you were on my show back, you know, 6 months ago or something like that, that there is a sense in which when there's a new type of media, it's chaotic in the beginning. What are we going to allow? What are we not going to allow? But I think it's, you know, after a while, it reaches a level of stability where now we sort of know how it works. And so it's not going to be this huge jumps like up and down and back and forth. We're going to allow this. No, we're going to have free speech. We're not going to have free speech. We're going to have extremely like narrow tolerance and so on. So I just think that it's also a process of maturity. I think that the social media platforms have matured in the sense that now they sort of know what they want to do, because it takes a few years of experience to understand how a new mass medium works. So I think that's a factor. But I also think that there's a factor that the establishment will have abandoned the whole woke thing in the same way that the left abandoned the working class, you know, where, you know, people like the Frankfurt School, for example, like people like Herbert Marcuse, who said explicitly that, you know, we realize that the working class wasn't really on board with the left-wing values because they were actually more conservative than the more bourgeois. So we realized that we had the wrong analysis, and then we realized that we had to appeal to these other groups who wanted this more left-leaning transformation of society. And it's not like they're going to change their minds and go back to supporting, like, workers' unions and like the working class, they've changed their paradigm for how to deal with modern society. I think the whole establishment, there is a sense, I mean, I did say that it's like the old establishment has given way to a new establishment, but that's also sort of a simplified way of speaking, because there's a sense in which it is the same establishment as well. It's just that they've, you know, they've adapted. So it's not like there's been any kind of revolution in society. I just think that there has been a paradigm shift in the way they see and how to best deal with this problem. You know, the problem of civilizational decline, the problem of multiracialism, religious, ethnic disunity in society, how to deal with that. Well, is it really in their interest to sort of pit these people to against each other and like create like this war, like civil war in their own society? I don't think so. I think they have realized and come to the conclusion, and I'm not speaking about this in any kind of like protocols of the Elders of Zion that everyone's like sat around the table, what are we going to do now? And like a smoke-filled room in some basement. I just mean that this is like a natural process where more and more they have come to the conclusion that maybe that's not a great strategy for ruling a society, to like create this like big civil war that you can't control with groups that you have no power over because they don't adhere to the values that you're trying to appeal to when you're trying to rule society, you know? So I think that they are just have created another model for running society. And I don't think they're going to go back to the old one because it's not, because they realize it doesn't work. It's like paradigm shift in their own interest.
Yeah, yeah. But I also don't think that the new model will work either, because I think too much has happened. The foreigners are here in all of our countries in too big numbers. They've already grown too cocky and confident and expectant, yeah. Demanding. They're not going to calm down now. No. I just don't see that happening. I can see an establishment trying to say to them, hey, just drop all this identity stuff and just be a winner. Come on, just join the competitive society and compete against everyone else and be a winner. And yeah. Then I can imagine that absolutely falling on its face.
Absolutely.
I think it's too late. It's too late for that.
They're not going to fix it. They're not going to fix it. This is more like, I don't know. It's like if you're a person who's just taken a lot of loans and then like you realize, okay, maybe I'm going to stop taking loans. That's not going to fix your problem immediately. You've already taken too, like many of these, what do you call them in English? Like these quick loans you text and then it's like 1,000% interest.
yeah.
Like these usury, yeah. You know what I mean? Like
yeah,
this sort of really sort of proletarian loans. And it's like you take new loans to pay it off. And like you, that's accumulated and you're already in a mess. And like what they've realized, okay, let's at least stop taking those, more of those loans. You know? And I mean, it's like, yeah, maybe they've, you know, stop digging, but they're already in a hole that's too deep. They're not going to get out of it, but at least they've sort of tried. They think, okay, if we stop digging now, maybe it's going to fix itself. No, the current society is in terminal decline. There is no turning it around unless, you know, we do things like you and I would like, perhaps, but, but they're not going to do that. They're going to try the sort of the individualist path, but, you know, at least that's going to give us some advantages, some disadvantages too. I'm not saying it's all good, but there are. But I don't have any illusions. They're not going to fix the society. It's in terminal decline. It's over. This collapse will not be turned around. And so, absolutely. But they've definitely, I think, realized that. Well, the old sort of super woke model it doesn't work. It's not in their own interest because it just makes society, in a way, more difficult to rule for reasons like we said. For example, it's their own stupid ideology that put forth a candidate like Kamala Harris. She's obviously, you know, she didn't get there for her qualifications, you know.
No. But if they go down this individualist route, and as you say it, and I agree that it's not going to work, then that might lead to remigration. Because if the establishment has visibly tried to treat everyone as individuals and sort of push that idea, then yeah. well, this, and then it doesn't work, then at least some at the elite level might conclude they're going to have to go back. If we can, we've tried placating them with wokery, we've tried treating them as individuals with this now, nothing works. It's still as bad as ever. It's worse than ever.
Yeah,
they're going to have to go back. I mean, I don't know. That's very optimistic, what I just said. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but I'm saying that's one possible route by which we could arrive at remigration. The question is whether those in, at the top of society would ever thole such an idea, at least not without total collapse. Yeah. All right. On that happy note, we'll get to the Super Chats. And there have been three very generous Super Chats on Odyssey. So thank you very much for that, Shambolics, Mr. Roboto, and Alt White. So we'll go through these. Shambolics says, Merry Christmas and Good Yule to two of the most articulate, authentic, and consistently thoughtful voices in our thing. Thank you very much. And Merry Christmas and Good Yule to you. Question.
Shambolics is a great guy. I had him on the Decameron Film Festival. He's a brilliant guy, very nice supporter of my channel, my work as well. So thank you for that.
All right. Okay.
And Merry Christmas.
Question for Woz. Are the banquet streams invite only or can anyone join? Woz hoping to add to the Rhodesian Canadian perspective. There isn't one about Rhodesia. There's going to be a Canadian one. And yes, you can certainly join that. I'll get your contact details from Frody. So yes, you can take part in that. They are invite only. I only want for this year. I want them just to be figures, people who are already streamers, who already are seasoned in that. There is going to be one that is open to the general public at the very end. I've got no idea what that's going to be like, and I'm quite nervous about it actually. But we'll just have to see how it goes. but that's going to be, I think, on the 30th or maybe the 29th. I can't remember. If you have a look at the schedule, you'll see when that's going to be. But yes, the Canadian one, Shambolics, you can certainly join that. Thank you for that super chat. Mr. Roboto, in crypto circles, there is a when Lambo saying, which means when will you have earned enough to afford a Lamborghini? I prefer asking when ethno, as in when will I have earned enough to help bring about the ethno state? We must do better in 2025. Happy Christmas, Yule to all. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Roboto. Yeah, I agree. I mean, this is why with Walt Bismarck, I was saying, want people to get rich. And I know it sounds vulgar and all the rest of it, but for God's sake, it's got to be better than being penniless. If our guys can be G'd up to become successful in life, I want that. And then, of course, if they can help support the movement, I certainly want that as well. Frody?
Yeah, first I want to thank Mr. Roboto. He is a very loyal supporter of my work as well. He's a great guy. So thank you so much for supporting this live stream. And I agree. I mean, there's a sense in which there's this lie about Jews that they're sort of just greedy and they're cheap and so on. No, they're extremely generous. That's why they're powerful. It's precisely because they're extremely generous. That's why they're powerful. When they get rich, they support political movements, metapolitical movements, projects, and so on that are in their interest. White people haven't gotten around to that understanding yet, and that's why we fail. It's obvious to me that if you do work that is important and that you believe in, then you should be able to do that. That should be encouraged that you should do that full time. We should have people doing that full time. It's just obvious to me. I mean, an organization like the ADL has an annual budget, a yearly budget of like $50 million. They have a staff of full-time employees who can do their work. That's why they're powerful. That's why they can you know, dedicate time and effort and have professionals doing important work. That's how lobbying works. That's how power works in modern society. And we can't even, I mean, a lot of people doing the stuff that we do probably need like a secretary or someone who like does, helps us with like stuff that we shouldn't be spending time on. We should be writing, recording, creating media, creating information. You know, a lot of people ask me, when's the next conference going to be? Well, it's expensive to set up a conference. I don't have a budget for it. You know, we need that. So I agree 100% with Mr. Roboto. People, when they get into a certain position, they should definitely support projects they believe in. People who are sincere and genuine that they believe in and do valuable work, they should be supported. That's how people become powerful. That's how people become influential, not by, you know, just doing shit for fun all the time. I mean, if you want serious stuff, you have to be serious about it. And you know, if you want alternative media, you have to support alternative media and so on. And like sometimes people, it's like they pretend that they don't understand the importance of media. It's like, well, the Jews run the media and they control of society. And then they say in the next sentence, well, what, you're just doing like live streams or something. Why should we? I mean, there's a problem here, you know?
Yeah. As I've said before, I think there's a certain strain in our community who think that people should be suffering while they're doing good work. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they're not doing it for the right reasons. They're not quite sincere. That's just
in a just world, the people who do the most important work should be the well-off, should be best rewarded for it.
It's also just it's just asking for failure, because people are going to be demoralized, miserable, penniless, and you think they're going to do good work. Well, I mean, the thing is, you can do that when you're in your 20s and you don't need to be thinking about your future and your family and all that. You can be the starving artist. But when you're in your 40s, like we are, you've got to be thinking about the long term. And that goes for everyone. And I mean, I could talk about this for ages, but let's not. I just think that I completely agree with you that if we're going to be a serious movement, then yes, it needs to be funded. It's the road to ruin to think that people should do it for the love of it or because it's the truth or because whatever. In the end, we all live in this world and basically things happen because they are funded or they don't happen because they weren't funded. And it was just an idea that someone had once. That's
Can I just add a quick comment on that? I'm not going to, stay too long on the point, but there is a sense in which, people should do it because it's what they believe in. But there are a lot of people who have, built up a lot of credibility by making sacrifices and doing what they believe in and who do valuable work that's valuable enough to be, to be supported and to make it successful. And so there's a difference between that and people who like see an opportunity, we've seen over the years that some people who are, used to be popular on social media and then that trend went away. And then they said, well, looks like a lot of people are doing this type of thing and like right-wing thing. I'm going to do that now. That's a completely different thing, but you can usually make a pretty easy distinction between the two.
Absolutely. Something that infuriated me was I saw some people. It's always horrible to be misrepresented, to see yourself being misrepresented by others. It's one of the things that Kipling mentions in If, actually, because it's such a specific annoyance. And someone was saying that once the alt-right thing faded away, I jumped on the COVID bandwagon because that's where the money was. And I thought, well, I never saw any of this fucking money. What are you talking about?
I'll tell you that.
It was as if it was alien to this guy who was speaking that you might do something because you actually believe in it. And so it speaks more of him than it does of me. It doesn't speak of me at all. He's completely wrong.
I've done this for, been involved in for more than 20, 25 years or whatever. And it's always been a total of a net loss for me financially. I can tell you that. So I mean, it's people who don't want to do anything. You know, that's what they say doesn't really matter in the end.
Yeah, that's true. That there is a lot of it is jealousy, or just misery. Like, well, I'm miserable, so I want everyone else to be miserable as well.
Yeah.
All right. And then finally, Alt White said Merry Christmas and give a very generous donation. Thank you very much for those three super chats. And then there were some also posted elsewhere. Let me see. All right. I think there are actually quite a few. So I'm going to have to message the Arvol and tell them we're going to be a bit late. I apologize, everyone. Whisker said, a very Merry Christmas to you gentlemen and all listening. Frody mentioned the Ritchie Boys of World War II and a new book about them on a stream with Greg the other day. Woz, have you heard of the Ritchie Boys? No, I haven't. They were very influential in everything we know about the war today. No, I haven't mentioned them. Frody, is there anything you'd like to say about this?
I'm not an expert on the Ritchie Boys. There's a new book that came out. I think it's called The Quiet Contingent. It came out like earlier this year or something, just a few months ago. It's like 700 pages or something with like short biographies of the Ritchie Boys. So the Ritchie Boys were psychological warfare operation at the end of the World War II. And the interesting thing about the Ritchie Boys, they were called so because they were part of Camp Ritchie, R-I-T-C-H-I-E, Ritchie. And the people who were involved in these kind of psychological warfare operations in Germany and elsewhere, from the American point of view, they were also involved in quote-unquote denazification of Europe after the war and also creating political correctness in America after the war. So that's why those people are interesting to study, but they haven't really been given a whole lot of attention in media. So that's a big project, but there is that book, The Quiet Contingent, with I don't know how many short biographies of the people involved, but seems like that's at least a starting point for the discussion.
Okay. And Unit Tactics said, is the anti-woke push a positive? The woke movement was creating an us versus them dichotomy, which was leading more whites to see themselves as a distinct tribe, seeing the attack on. Will destroying wokeness not put them back on the merry-go-round? Well, we've addressed this, but I think that is a danger. That it makes people complacent again. But I don't actually think it will, because as I said, things have just moved forward. The thing, too much has happened for that genie to go back in the bottle. Deconstruct said, join Liberty Veterans Association in petitioning President Trump for justice for victims of the attack on the USS Liberty. Okay, well, people have been made aware of that. The Liberty Veterans Association. You might want to look into that. Stephen says, to be frank, I'd be pissed no matter who went off with 7 of 9. I called dibs back in the late 90s. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. All right. He also said, happy Yule. Frody, keep up the good work. And don't count us red state Southerners and Appalachians and Heartlanders out just yet. We are more based and in favor of union dissolution than most people know. All right. Okay, thank you.
No, I have a lot of, there's a lot of good stuff going on in America. America has a lot of advantages over Europe as well. So I'm not counting anyone out. I do think that the current political system in America is bankrupt though, but I don't think hope is lost for America as such. America is a continent. It's not just like a normal country. It's a continent. And it has some of the highest quality people in Europe went to America. One of the first things they did was to start these elite universities. The sort of Protestant, really highbrow Europeans went there. And so, I mean, America has a lot of potential. So I'm not counting you out. Make no mistake about it.
All right. And Black Pigeon Pilled said, I really appreciated Frody's choice of country and venue for Scanza. Thanks for that. What are his plans for the next one, and would Uncle Jared be permitted in Königsberg, do you think?
Would Uncle Jared be admitted in Königsberg, Kaliningrad, in Russia? Probably. I don't know. I don't think he would be banned from Russia. But the plans for the next conference are a bit iffy now. I announced, I don't want to spend too much time talking about this on this show, but I announced a fundraiser to be able to set up a conference early next year. That has not really picked up speed. It hasn't really taken off. So I haven't really gotten where I need to be. So that's why the conference next year is on thin ice right now. So I don't really know if it's going to happen or not. But I'll definitely announce it on my channels if we're going to be able to pull it off. I've already invited speakers. I've already, you know, started paying for things and you know, tickets and flights and venues and everything. But as things look now, it's going to be pretty difficult to pull it off. So I'll update that on my own platforms.
Okay, people might want to look out for that if they would like to help to make that conference happen. They should obviously look at Frody's Telegram and Twitter and so on, which are linked underneath this video.
Thank you.
And Stephen also said, it's good to consider American politicians and American dissident right content creators don't quite represent the average founding stock dissident right American. We're of one mind with y'all. We're a bunch of Northwestern Euros who want dissolution and balkanization mostly. Yeah, I think that's probably, I can understand that's where a lot of people's thoughts are going. And I think in the long term, it seems inevitable to me that America will break up. But again, I don't really know what I'm talking about. That's just going on an intuitive appraisal of the situation. This country isn't going to be tenable forever, for very long.
Yeah.
And then Hal 9000 said, I disagree and with what we were saying at that time. Mm-hmm. Anti-white policies are central to this globalist one world coup. Equity policies proliferate in housing and local authority recruitment. The policies are published online, and believe me, they are being implemented apace, affecting millions of jobs in the UK. That's true. That is true. And again, that's another factor that, and I don't mean to discount all of that, to dismiss it. It's another factor that's in the mix. What we are talking about is the direction of travel and the average, and which tendency is going to win out. That's what Frody and I are trying to discern here. But as I said, a lot of this stuff is still continuing. It's not, I don't think it's going to go away completely, even in America, but definitely not. And this was a big thing that Morgoth did a very interesting video about this. The woke North Korea, is Britain going to be the woke North Korea? In other words, is Keir Starmer and his crazy, insane Labour Party, are they going to have us continuing on the woke nonsense while America and perhaps other European countries go off on the individualist thing? Is it in Keir Starmer to do that? Or is he so wedded, and the Labour Party that he represents, are they so wedded to the social justice stuff that they can't let it go? So we would be the last bastion of this insanity while everyone else is moving on. It's very possible. We'll see. His speech about immigration a few weeks ago would suggest that he's a bit more pragmatic than we perhaps thought when Morgoth did that video.
I just want to add briefly to that point that when we're talking here, we're talking in a sort of a big picture general terms. So first of all, I don't believe that like any one person or any five people are in magical control of everything that happens in society, and that they're going to snap their fingers and everything turns around overnight. I expect there to be gradual changes. And so absolutely, I agree with the commenter here that we're not going to see, complete 180 change overnight. we're talking about general trends here. It's like the weather forecast, you know. It's like in general terms, it's going to start moving in this direction. And we're talking about big long-term overview and really the big picture here. So we're not talking about like in every detail, this is going to exactly turn around 180. Absolutely not.
Yeah, exactly. There was one final super chat from Construct, and he asked, can you get Mr. White Tuber on next year, Bose? I've heard of that. I've heard that name, but I don't know what his content is like. I will obviously look into it. Thank you for the suggestion. But obviously no guarantees. Maybe he doesn't want to do it. Maybe I'm not sure that he's quite, it wouldn't fit in, whatever. Who knows? I'll look into his stuff and we'll see. But thank you for the suggestion. All right. Frody, I guess that's it. Is there, I think it's been a great conversation. So thank you very much. Yeah. Is there anything you'd like to say in summary or to the viewers before we finish?
Well, no, I just want to thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here always, and it's a privilege to be invited year after year. And I hope this continues another 10 years. This is Millennial X. I hope it's going to be Millennial 20. You know, and this is extremely valuable. So I'd encourage the viewers to support it also, you know, financially, because it takes a lot of work and it has to be encouraged. What it's, people work by way of, you know, behaviorism. I saw just a moment of your talk with Jared Taylor the other day, and he brought up Skinner, B.F. Skinner, right? And it's behaviorism, what gets encouraged continues, what gets discouraged stops. And so if you want to encourage, get more of this, it's simple conditioning, behaviorist conditioning. Encourage it, support it, and it continues. So that's very important. I think this is one of the most important projects out there. So I'm it's a privilege to be part of it. I want to wish everyone happy Yule, Merry Christmas. And if you want to follow my channel, my work, I'm at gtkradio.com. I do a weekly show every Tuesday with Mark Weber, weekly roundup, a news roundup. And in addition to everything else I do. Thank you so much for watching. Happy Christmas. Please support Woz with his effort with Millennial. And thank you so much for having me on.
All right, you're very welcome, and thank you for those kind words about Millennial. It would be nice if 10 years from now there is Millennial XX. That would be quite cool.
But and then we'll XXX.
See. Yeah. By then I'd be, what, 63 or something? 62. I don't know. That sounds a bit Mitch McConnell-esque, perhaps. All right, on that note.
All right. Thank Frody, you so much.
I've enjoyed this very much. I'll be back very soon with Arvel. In the meantime, Frody Medjord, thank you for appearing on Millennial X.
Merry Christmas. Thank you.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial, but how about giving something back to your tireless host? Commemorating 10 years of Millennial, this unique animated vector graphic is available as an NFT for one lucky owner, and only one. The auction closes on the 30th. Make your bid today.